Someone wants to turn it off. Revered Rebbe, Chavarim, and dear friends. Needless to say that I am most deeply honored at this unique privilege. I believe that I am among the first of our Rebbe's Talmidim who has had this course of introducing him at a national rabbinic convention. And with this chus also goes the obligation to follow the words of the Rambam, who had said in Hilchos Talmud Torah, Perek Chamishi, that the Osa La'odom La'horos Tifnei Rabo La'olam. Lahoros probably may mean not only to paskin shalas, but also to teach and give chidushei Torah. So may I therefore present Moreinu v'Rabbeinu Harav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik.
You can easily talk on the side, it's a very good one.
Okay, fine, so I can easily talk catch my own.
Okay, fine.
Not the Rambam, I thought it's
the Rambam. No.
So give me just the sheet, one of the sheets.
Here. I have it.
It's okay. I have it here. Thank you very much. I'll telephone, but I came here with great difficulty, and I simply have no time to organize my lecture. I'll call it a shiur. I don't care, because I have been so busy with Melandes that I have no time for myself. I'm not Chassid Sholem boastful, on the contrary. I have three shurim in New York and yeshiva. Now my shir at the yeshiva is the shortest, it's 3 hour shir. It's a little longer, it's 4 hours. I spent even today in the classroom 3 hours. No. And then I have a shir in Maria for 2 hours. I have in Boston two shurim now, public shurim. One Saturday night in Chumash and Ramban. Whatever I'll tell you is an outgrowth of my shir in Boston, which I said last Saturday night. And I have a shiur in Gemara Sunday morning between 11 and 1. And then, in addition to it, I engage in private melamda, sirkanel too. I study with my grandson, I study with my son-in-law, I study with my nephew. So, between private lessons, melamda, so all the years off. If you were Rothschild, you would make melamda. I came, all right. I don't know why I came anyway.
Thank you.
Let me just try to analyze the Rambam. And again, I want to make the following remarks. My grandfather Reb Chaim introduced a new method in the study of halacha. As a matter of fact, it's not Reb Chaim, I once heard it from my father, and I simply didn't understand why my father studied, but finally, I mean, later I realized that he was right. He said it would have been impossible now to study with boys who are trained scientifically, if not for the method which my father, Papate, has developed. And this is true. Because the method of Reb Chaim is a very modern method. And it does not lag behind the most modern method developed by by contemporary logic or metaphysics or philosophy, I can tell you that, and I'm not now in an apologetic mood. I mean, I don't apologize, it is true. That's why it is possible to study with boys who are by profession mathematicians and so forth. I mean, to study with them, I mean, Allah, Yush, Lemadas, Havi Yush, Havi Yush, Havi Yush, and the boys enjoy it very much. Not only that, our method commands respect of the intellectual, of the modern intellectual. It's a method of conceptualization, of definition, classification, and particularly to look for unity in Allah. Not to be satisfied with words, but understand that each word represents an idea. The idea should be properly defined and formulated and so forth. Not to worry about questions, not to try to answer kashas. This is not the main task of this was not the main task of Chaim, but simply to see the problem. The children of Rabbi Kveger, in the introduction to the Tush Vechidu side, the Rabbi Kveger was a forerunner of Rabbi Chaim, basically. He foreshadowed, I mean, forecast Rabbi Chaim's method, basically. So it said, Leho Yesomeach, Leho Yamitztayer al Akusho, Leho Yesomeach Batiris. He never spent his sleepless nights because of a kasha, nor did he rejoice in the Teretz. Important is not the kasha, important is not the Teretz, important is the problem. Once the problem is stated, whether or not the problem is soluble or is it not soluble, I mean, there are mathematical equations which are insoluble, and the mathematician does not lose much sleep on account of that. This is as far as Allah is concerned. As far as Chumash is concerned, Tanakh, there was no Reb Chaim. And that's why our knowledge of Chumash of Tanakh is very limited. We know the text, we twist the Chumash, the text on Chumash, I mean, for homiletical purposes. We never try to conceptualize the Chumash, to read between the lines, and simply to see the world through the eyes of the Tanakh. I mean, I'm trying somehow to gain an insight into the world of the Chumash, I mean, the way Chazal have understood, and the way, I mean, our tradition has. And to simply to see the image which our tradition has projected. And that's, I mean, one of the best mefarshim, not the best, one of the best mefarshim, for that is the Ramban. The Ramban was very sensitive to every word of Chumash. His spiritual perceptions are so fine that actually they may be exploited and taken advantage of for the organization and construction of a modern philosophy of religion. In my opinion, the Ramban has contributed much more to the philosophy of religion and to Jewish world formula, to the Ashkafas Elam, than the Amir Nebuchadnezzar. The Ramban was overeducated, overtrained. When you are overtrained and overeducated, willy-nilly you have to employ cliches. And you have to engage in a certain jargon which each generation develops. I mean, each philosophical school, each kufa, each period develops a certain jargon. And the jargon shuts out the sight, I mean, of spiritual perceptions, of the Rebbeinu Shel Olam, basically. I mean, the trouble is that the Rambam was a scholar trained in philosophy. The Ramban used more intuition than logic. Ingrid was a great logician. He was very original, because there was no Aristotle or Plato or Socrates, I mean, to deprive him of his originality and uniqueness. And that's why I would recommend everybody to study Ramban the way you study Exegesis and Hesedus. Let me just try now to develop a more Ramban as Lech Lecha. Because why should we so delve into the personality of Neach? So Neach is the father of humanity, so let the go into it. I would rather, I mean, give our attention, I mean, to Abraham, who is our father. Vayemer Adishem el Avrohom, Lech Lecho Me'artzachom, Maladetecho, no chidushim, just simple hermeneutics and simple understanding of the words of the Ramban, and to analyze, I mean, exactly what he wants. Vayemer Adishem el Avrohom, Lech Lecho Me'artzachom, Umaladetecho, Umubeis Avich Al Oretz Asha Areko. Basically, what I wrote down it since yesterday. I started to write yesterday afternoon. I wrote it down. I finished it at 3:15. Rabbi Feiner can bear witness to that. So basically, it consists of two parts. One part I deal exclusively with a methodological problem. According to the Ramban, but I'm not going to deliver the paper, to read this paper, it will be too long. According to the Ramban calls Sefer Bereishis Sefer HaYetzirah. You have it here. You have it here. It's a little funny. Sefer HaYetzirah. This is my course of Sefer Bereishis to Sefer HaYetzirah. בחידוש העולם ויצירת כל יצור ובמקרה יהוה יסקולם. You have it? יש לנו ספר בראשית. It's a ספר אלי שמייס. יש לנו יש לנו הקוס של ספר בראשית. The course of the pasuk has concluded the book of Bereishis. It is the book of Yitzira, of creation, Genesis, of course. It is called Sefer Yetzirah because Chidush Hayom, there is the story of creation. Chidush Hayom Yetzirah is called Meitzar. So basically Sefer Yetzirah should be limited to the first two sections of Bereishis. Down to Vayichulu, and perhaps the second section. Begin Brei Elokim Shamayim Vaaretz. Again, the story of the creation of man is repeated, the creation of Eve. The story of creation of Eve is told. But the Ramban says no, the word Yetzirah embraces not only the section of Yetzirah Sa'ilam, but the entire book, down to the death of Jesus. With the Mikre Yehov Iskulam, in the experiences, the story of the experiences of our patriarchs, Shehein Kein Yetzirah Lezaram, because what happened to them is paradigmatic, I would say, or characteristic of events which their descendants had encountered later. Because what happened to them, all the events in the lives of the patriarchs, siyure dvorim, just I would say are forecasts or foreshadowings, yes, or allusions or symbols, numesule idea, in order to enlighten us, Kolosit Lave Elohim, whatever the future holds in store for the Jewish people as such. According to the Ramban, it's not just paradise. The events in the lives of the fathers are not just paradise, or just symbols, which expose factor, it means. In retrospect, we try to interpret in terms of historical events or historical patterns. Not only that those events are significant for the understanding of history. According to Ramban, there is predetermination. Whatever happened to the others has predetermined, the future developments and the future trends and events of the Jewish history. The Ramban, that this is true, we have I ask you, where's Vayitze? Vayavon Boaz, where is it? It's four. I know where Vayavon Boaz is, but Vayavon Boaz. Ein Aloch Klau. Ein Aloch Klau. I'll find you to move. So understand it with regard to all the sections, all the stories. With respect to the events which happened, which took in the lives of the patriarchs, the boys of all Frankies. It's a very important matter, to which our sages have alluded. Briefly, we all call Mashiach Lord is similar to whatever happened to the fathers is significant as far as posterity is concerned. That's why the Ksuvim are very extensive. The Sipur HaMasois in narrating, the wanderings of the Oveis, Vachfiras Aber is the digging of the wells, Ushur HaMikrim and other events. The Yachshir HaHeshiv and the casual reader my seeing Kilo in Dvorim, you saw him, it's completely superfluous. And then tell us there is no use, I mean, it's useless. The Kulam Boim Lelame Dalaosit, and every event which is narrated in this Torah is actually forecast a future event, a future experience to be encountered by the Bnei Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov. And then he says one sentence, Kikasha Yodei HaMikra, this is the most important sentence. This in itself wouldn't be so, I mean, so sensational, but the Yach, Kasha Yodei HaMikra LeNavi, Mishleishes Ravi, when one of the three patriarchs met with an experience, or witnessed an event, is benen nemenu hadovor anikzer lovel ezare. You may derive from this event conclusions pertaining to events which will transpire in the history of the people. Kikashi, veda kol gzeras imin, any divine decree, kasha teitze miki agzer ala peel, when it is translated into reality, into historical experience, al peel dinyan, it means into a symbolic historical experience, tiri agzer ala miskayemes akolpanim. Once it has been, I mean, translated into an event in the life of an individual, so the decree can never be invalidated, will never be invalidated, will have to be later to be realized and fulfilled in the lives of the descendants. It means that Ramban speaks here about predeterminism. The stories of the others, the lives of the others, have predetermined and fixed the events and experiences to be encountered by posterity. Now, of course, the problem is of predeterminism and freedom. I mean, for instance, according to Rambam, Chuvim by Yisrish and Chuvim by Sheni was already forecast and foreshadowed by certain events in the life of Yitzchok, the Sfiras HaBeres. According to the Sfiras HaBeres, one well is symbolic of Yisrish, the second well is symbolic of Sheni. This digging and filling in of the wells, I mean, actually represent actually the establishment or the construction of the bais and the destruction. The bina bais and chuma bais. So what I mean, what's the use of when Yishayo, I mean, address himself to the people and tell them if they'll sin, so the bismillah will be destroyed and they'll be deported, exiled from the land, and if they'll repent and amend their ways, then I mean they'll. They'll remain an independent people, and the Beis Hamikdash will continue to exist throughout the centuries. I mean, it has been already predetermined by Avraham Yitzchak Yaakov, and so forth. This I have here. This is basically a paper how the Ramban understands freedom in Jewish history, particularly Bechira Chofshit, as far as sin and Shul are concerned. While on the other hand, he wants to see, I mean, the events, the experiences of the Oreis as determining and fixing, I mean, the future course of history. This is not now my problem. Let us start now, sir. It's not my problem now, and this is a more philosophical paper. Let us engage in simple pshat. Rashi already raised the question, and the Chachmis Sforat picked up the question, they were also aware of this problem. Abraham left Ma'at Chomor HaTechon Beis Avicho. Most probably, I mean, Ramban is the only one who disagreed. But however, all Parshani HaMikro, all Chachmi HaMikro have concurred in the opinion that Ma'at Chomor HaTechon Beis Avicho by Ma'at Chomor HaTechon Beis Avicho is meant Chaldea, Urkaz, not Chora. Because Abraham, according to them, according to Rashi, according to the Rambam also like that. The Rambam in Perek Aleph Milchet Avilizore, when he gives the biography of Avraham, I mean, or project the image of Avraham, the profile of Avraham, so he speaks, I mean, in terms which actually, I mean, are quite clear and unequivocal that Abraham was a native in Ur Kasdim, in Chaldea. and then the Ma'atz Chom Malanitach Chom Beis Avich Olor Etz Asher Areko, I mean, was related to his place, of death, and to his ancestral home in Urkazi. Now, is this the case? So Abraham left Urkazi long before his birthplace, long before the command of Lech Lecho was addressed to him. We read in Erech, Vayikach Terech Es Avram Bnei, Vesleib Ben Horom Ben Bnei, Vesorek Alos Eish Es Avram Bnei, Vayitzi Tom Urkazi Molech Es Afak Norom, Vayove Yad Chorom Vayish Vashom. Rashi says Rashi tries to resolve this difficulty by rearranging the order of the verse or the structure of the verse as Lech Lecho Me'artzecho Me'laretecho Me'beis Avicho. He said as follows: Me'artzecho Valekvor Yotso Mishom Imoviv Ubo Ad Lechoron Elokacho Me'lei Yisrachik Eid Mishom V'tzei Me'beis Avicho. Go still further away from your native land and depart, continue to remove yourself. To remove yourself from your native land and leave your father's home, which was established in Choron. It seems that Rashi places the emphasis upon Beis Avicho, which was established in Choron. The pasuk, if reconstructed, according to Rashi, would read as follows, I would say. He's trying to reconstruct. Lech lecho mebeis avicho, the beis avicho should come first. Me'artzecho meladetecho, go away from your ancestral home, which was established in by Terach in Choron, and by so doing, you will remove yourself still further from your native land and place of birth. I mean, this is Rashi's answer, more or less. Anyway, according to Rashi, Terach's migration from Ur-Kasdim, from Chaldea to Choron, was the result of a voluntary decision. No one told him to do so, because the order addressed to Abraham, I mean, did not precede Terach's migration to Choron, but followed it. The Ibn Ezra disagreed with Rashi. With Rashi's interpretation. The Ibn Ezra rearranges not the psukim, but the chronology. In Mukdem Muchabatir. The instructions, according to Ibn Ezra, the Rabban says, take a look at Rabban. The Rabban Avrom Piresh, you have it? The Rabban Avrom Piresh, who kvorom arashein el Avrohom, lech lecho me'artzecho, ki adibur hazeh, hoyo, בעידון ובו קרדין, ושום ציבור לעז ארצי ומלדתי ובי חוביס אשר שום. So according to Ibn Ezra, the instructions to depart from Ur Kasdim were revealed to Abraham prior to Terach's migration to Chor. The verses as 1-3 Lech Lecho, as Lech Lecho 1-3, according to Ibn Ezra, operating with the principle in Mugdum Mucha Batere, belong into the section of Nech. Before the verse 31, Vayikach Terach, the reconstructed parashe would read as follows: Vatisore Yakoro Eilo Volod Nech, Vayena Rabbi Shem al Avrom, Lech Lecho Me'artzecho Meladetecho, Umebeis Avicho, El Oretz Asher Areko, ויעשך לגי גודל, עבורך וגד לשמך, ויהי ברוך ועבורך ומרחך ומקלוך ועיר, ומכו כל משפחי סדומו, וייקח תרח את אברהם בני, וסלייב בנוח, this is the question by the Rambam, and that's exactly the question which we will deal with, this is the main question. וייקח תרח את אברהם בני, וסלייב בנוח ובן בני, וסורי קלוסי, איש את אברהם בני, וייצא איתו מורכזים ללך את ארץ הכנען, ויביא עד חורן, וישו שם, ויהי מתי החמישונים, ועשרים שלו, ויום אסתר הבכורן. How would the parsha לך לכו סטארט? וילך אברום כאשר דיבר עם עבד השם, וילך איתה לית, ואברום בחומש ושינו שונו בצייס ונחור. It means the first phase of the sort of story of the journey, I mean, is narrated in Neach. This is from Ur-Kazim, from Chaldea to Choron. The second phase of the migration, I mean, is recorded in Lech Lecho. Lech Lecho from Choron into Eretz Yisrael. The Ramban refused to accept it. And why did the Ramban refuse to accept it? Simply because the central figure, as far as the migration from Ur-Kazim to Choron, is Terach, not Avraham. Ve'ino nochin, the Ramban says, you have it, Ramban? Ve'ino nochin. Ki im kein oya Avraham ikach ha-nisiyo mi-beis ha-ref. It means Avraham should have taken the initiative. And Avraham should have been the one who organized this journey. The mitzvah of Hashem in compliance with the word of God. Ve'terach ovik b'rtzei nafshi olach. And the part of Terech was just a spontaneous decision. The Akosu Beimer, and the Akosu says, Vayikach Terech es Avrom Bnei Yere. I mean, it appears as if Ki Avrom Achrei Oviv Holach Uba'atsofi Yotzen Meretz Knan. It appears as if Avrom just, I mean, was obedient to his father and followed, I mean, his footsteps, as they followed him, I mean, into Choron. That's what I'm asking. It's a very serious question. In other words, it appears from the story in Inear that Terach took the initiative and he advanced the thought of migrating from Ur-Kazim. That Abraham followed on his father and did not act independently in conformity with God's word or instructions. This is a Rambam's question. If we should accept the interpretation of the Ibn Ezra, you could solve another riddle. Let us, I mean, I'll come back to the problem which the Ramban is pondering. Chazal, our sages have stated that Terach repented and embraced the new faith of which his son was preaching. And the Terach finally surrendered to the Lekei Avraham, whom he couldn't see and whom he couldn't understand. Yeah. Chazal, Rashi quotes Chazal, have derived this conclusion. It's almost sensational. Because the Pasuk in Yeshua says, Beivarano, Yoshua, Vesecha, Meilon, Terach Avi Avrom, Vavinocher, Vayavdelim Acherim. As if Terach actually had changed and repented and embraced, I mean, Avrom's faith, so the Pasuk would have mentioned it. But however, I mean, Chazal said so. Rashi quotes this Chazal, this Maimer, in Lech Lecho. V'ata tovi b'sholem yana v'yitzecho, v'kovya b'sheva g'deilo. So Rashi says, Ovi v'edi davedi zore oyo, v'u mivasri sheyove eilo. Father was an idol worshiper, an idolater. And Almighty tells Abraham that he will join his father. What kind of a psoe? The immediate conclusion to be inferred from this message is that Terach was converted to the faith of Avraham and became a tzad Gomor. It means Leilam Avraham, the world to come. In the future world, I mean, Terach will join, Avraham will join Terach. It's not only the Terach about Shuvah, but Terach's Madrege, what you call it, no, I mean, it's Chazal speak. Terach status or station Leilam Abor is almost equal to that of Abraham, because the pasuk said, "Va'ata tove b'sholem al v'secho t'kova b'seyom." I'm not asking any questions. I'm just trying to understand what Chazal says. However, what we miss is the direct tale of Terach's conversion. The Chumash should have told us directly. Maybe this is just an indirect inference, I mean. But should told us directly that Terach was converted to the faith of Avraham and embraced, I mean, the Lekei Yisrael. And also I would like to know the exact moment at which Terach did realize the futility of an idolatrous life and the absurdity of the entire pagan civilization, and he came and somehow embraced the Avraham's new terrain. When did it happen? After all, let us see it against the background, against the backdrop of Terach in his relation to Abraham. I mean, before he was converted. After all, according to the Haggadah, Terach conspired, whenever the king was, let's be numerous, to destroy Abraham physically and spiritually. That's according to the Haggadah. He was the one who informed the king of Abraham's blasphemous behavior vis-à-vis the images of the gods of Chaldea. It was Terach who wanted Abraham to be executed, and who, if not for the miraculous intervention of the Almighty, would have succeeded in implementing that plan. And I want to add something. Chazal tell us the story about Terach informing the king or the authorities about Abraham's abusive treatment of the idols and the gods of Chaldea. And the fact that Chazal, has emphasized the one who informed the king was Terach is indicative of something else. Usually, hatred between father and son. It happens quite often now. Antagonism between father and son. And usually, the hatred is on the part of the son vis-à-vis the father. It's not frequent that father should hate the son. Yeah. But when it happens, then such antagonism, such enmity borders on the psychopathic. It's not normal. Hostility, while hatred of a stranger, hatred of a stranger, of a person, some people you don't like, I wouldn't use the term hatred, we don't like, we feel some antagonism vis-à-vis them. So enmity vis-à-vis a stranger is not always a manifestation of some mental aberration or of his sick mind. Sometimes it's quite rational. I don't say it's not noble. It is a destructive emotion, but does not manifest insanity or mental aberration. Enmity, hostility, any kind of hostility between father and son, even if it's expressed in the most modern terms, modern sophisticated terms. We have many terms now to express hostility between father and son, or tension between father and son, or daughter, mother and daughter. Is any kind of tension, hostility, or enmity is a result of a sick soul and a personality which is permeated with hatred and which finds delight in destroying. It is insanity, basically. So Chazal tells us the story about Terach informing Nimrod of Abraham's blasphemous attitude of stand vis-à-vis the idols. Chazal wants to emphasize that he was sick with Terach, was sick with hostility, sick with hatred vis-à-vis his son, because he saw his son destroying the whole world. His whole life, everything he stood for, fought for, loved for, defended for, lived for. That's enough. Suddenly, the same Chazal, the same Chachmei Talmud, Chachmei Midrash, tell us that Terach repented. When did this remarkable change in Terach occur? Why did not the Bible tell us about it? About this wondrous transformation? I believe it according to Ibn Ezra, not only according to Ibn Ezra, but even according to Rashi. But we are now interested in Ibn Ezra because the Ramban raised the objection. According to Ibn Ezra and according to Rashi, the answer is simple. This unbelievable change took place. This unbelievable change took place when Terach decided to abandon Ur Kasdim and to migrate to Haran. Basically, it's a very strange decision. It was a very strange decision. Because it is Terach again. If we see him against the backdrop of the Midrash in Ragore, Terach was a prominent citizen in Urkazin. Even according to Ragore, he was a member of the royal council. He was related to the royal household. And suddenly, Chaldea, you see, when you speak about Choron and Chaldea, is to us, it's a simple matter. Simple matter to take, I mean, to buy a ticket and to get on the plane and to fly from Urkaz to Chaldea. And it is simple for the our brother in Eretz Israel, that all the entire American Jewish community should get, I mean, tonight on the plane and come to Eretz Israel. Yeah, it's simple. There is no problem involved. It is not, it wasn't so simple. Because we know very well what kind of a country Chaldea was. We have a lot of, I mean, that evidence, I mean, documentary evidence, I mean, which bear witness as to the character and to the nature of the Chaldean society and the Choron society. Chaldea was the most developed country in antiquity. I mean, next comes Egypt, came Egypt, but Chaldea was ahead of Egypt, basically. As a matter of fact, astronomical tables was a very developed, I mean, of course, relatively developed industrially, technologically, very advanced, I mean, the wondrous gardens, the hanging gardens, the suspended gardens, you know very well about them, I mean. And the society was quite sophisticated. We uncover now, I mean, actually, I mean, documents which actually, I mean, are so indicative of a sophisticated, progressive, and modern society, and also was a very disciplined country. To meet such a country and to emigrate from Urkazin with the intention of settling in Choron, which in comparison with Urkazin was very primitive. The society, when you read the Chumash, you don't need to go too far, society was a pastoral one. Not even agriculture was developed in Choron and in Knaa. It was a pastoral society which in comparison with the Chaldean was primitive in appearance. Usually one leaves the land with a lower civilization in order to migrate to a country with a higher civilization. I mean, to act the reverse of that principle is not it's unusual. What prompted Terach to act so strangely? What motivated him to break up his home and to uproot his household and to abandon luxury, whatever he had there, convenience, renown, influence, and power, and become a wanderer, an immigrant, or a straying Chaldean, as Aram HaLudovia means? The answer is simple. He wrote Shuvah. I ask, where did the Torah tell us about this wondrous, miraculous transformation in the mind and the heart of the, I would say, he was actually the idolater in Chaldea. According to the Chazal, he was a manufacturer of idols. It's not a question of manufacturing. He was the father of the idolatrous philosophy and ideology, I mean. Respected and revered by an idolatrous society. But why suddenly, I mean, abandon everything and go forth to a primitive country? He wrote Shuvah. The realization that whatever he stood for and fought for is absurd, the great disenchantment in a highly disciplined and advanced pagan civilization, and the thought that perhaps his son Abraham was right, and that the novel and shocking ideas he has been preaching for so long reflect the divine truth. This is exactly what made Terach decide to abandon his country. In a word, the reappraisal of the Baal Teshuvah is responsible for the decision to leave Urkazin and start out for a primitive land, either in Choron or in Eretz Israel, but apparently with the intention to begin life anew from this scratch. As a matter of fact, it's very strange, according to Nazareth. It's not a simple Ramban concept. The divine decree addressed to Abraham to leave country and home and go forth to unknown land coincided with the great transformation or metamorphosis which took place within Terah's personality. It wasn't just a coincidence in time. God actually waited for this moment to arrive. And as soon as this moment of change arrived, and Terah, who was ready to migrate, to leave, to abandon everything, I mean, it's a supreme sacrifice. Lamed Shaderech, you know what Chazal described in their unique way what immigration means, how destructive immigration is, when a man uproots himself and dislocates himself completely and becomes homeless. This great decision, this great change in Terach didn't just coincide with the revelation of God to Abraham, but God waited for this great change. And once Terach has arrived at the final decision, the final conclusion, so immediately the message came through to Abraham, you go forth. The God's commandment to Abraham to emigrate from Ur Chaldea came at the same time when Terach had undergone the great dramatic change and had decided to give everything up and go forth to a new world. The Terach doesn't tell us, it's very hard to guess, whether Terach knew of Abraham's rendezvous with the invisible God. How much Terach knew about Abraham, we don't know. You know, I mean, the gaps in the Terach are sometimes shocking. But the Terach did not tell us things which are irrelevant to the main development or unfolding of ideas. I mean, I'm just departing from my text. It's very strange. Do you know what did Abraham look like? Was he tall? Was he short? Was he heavy? Or was he thin? Was he dark? Or was he light? Was he blonde? Or brunette? Or was he a human being? What kind of a complexion did he have? The Torah doesn't tell us. In Tanakh you find about it. About David, the Torah tells us. The Tanakh tells us. Admini, Feyanaim. Feyanaim. About Shaul, Mishich, Meir, Meilah, Mikol. And so forth on. In Chumash, there is not a single description of the countenance or the personality of the person. Yes, but we find for it when the Torah says, Yifastir, Fasmare, in two places. With regard to Yosef, with reference to Rochu, and with Rochu, not the contrary, Rein, Rein, Rakes. And with respect to Sora, Ato Yadati Kishi Fastera, why did Tere introduce, I mean, physical traits, I mean, the description of physical traits, because it's important as far as the relevance to the unfolding of the evidence. If Sora had not been also, I mean, Esav Advani means he was mature. It's important, I mean, it's relevant to evidence. In the Torah there is not a single departure from the highway which leads straight to the destination which the Torah is headed for. Destination means the unfolding of the drama of a covenantal community and the realization of a great vision, I mean, which has been foreshadowed, I mean, by the patriarchs. As a matter of fact, I mean, if you take, there is one place I find in the Torah, where the Torah somehow departs and takes I would say, a country road, and leave the highway. When Avram went to the Haram Riha, now apparently during what happened after all, I mean, Avram met people, and perhaps Avram was in Avram, I don't know that Avram knew the way to the Haram Riha, didn't know the way. He might have inquired of people how to get to the Haram Riha or to the Haram Riha. He inquired. The theory doesn't tell us, not at all. But the theory is only bent on one subject matter. Subject matter is Avram's compliance and who leads that divine order. If you'll take, there is one place I find in the Torah where the Torah somehow departs and takes, I would say, a country road and leaves the highway. When Avram went to the Haram Riha, apparently during what happened after all, I mean, Avram met people, and perhaps Avram was in Avram, I don't know that Avram knew the way to the Haram Riha, didn't know the way. He might have inquired of people how to get to the Haram Riha or to the Haram Riha. He inquired. The theory doesn't tell us, not at all. But the theory is only bent on one subject matter. Subject matter is Avram's compliance and who needs that divine order and the sacrifice of Yitzchok on the altar. Interesting is when Yosef went out to search for his brothers, so the Torah for one moment departs from narrating the main story and tells us Vayimtzu Yish Teye Basole. There was no need. He sent him to Shem. So the Torah says, Vayove Shem, and the Motze is Shem, Vayove Deisam. I mean, the Torah is not interested to tell us, I mean, what happened between him and who directed him to Deisam. But still the Torah has departed from narrating the main story, the main fabula, and has said, Vayimtzu Yish Teye Basole. You know why? That was prompted Chazal to say, Zeh Davreel. That basically that Yosef's mission was not basically planned by Jacob. Even Jacob was the one who sent Yosef, who charged Yosef with the mission, I mean, of finding his brother. Jacob shouldn't have done it, for a simple reason, Rambam noticed, because he knew very well the enmity between the brothers and Yosef, and exposed them to danger, I mean, he knew very well. Why didn't Yosef do it? As Chazal said, actually he was constrained, he was forced to do it. The divine providence has led Jacob, I mean, had made Jacob to give the order, the mandate to Yosef to find his brothers. And when the mandate, I mean, Yosef could not carry out the mandate because he didn't find them in Shem, someone else intervened. Who is someone? Gabriel. I mean, it is someone mysterious. Because the covenant had to be realized. And the old prediction or the old saying by God, Kikir Yizaracha, had to be translated into reality. Of course, the Torah is not interested to tell us actually how much the Terach know about it. Do they know about his rendezvous with God under the starry skies of Chaldea? Hard to ascertain, you don't know. Equally difficult is to know, is to answer. Equally difficult to answer is the question whether Abraham ever told Terach about the instructions to receive from God pertaining to the journey to Eretz Yisrael, Eretz Kanaan. You don't know, you know, whether Terach was letting in this secret, or Abraham confided in Terach, or did not confide. We don't know. The Torah doesn't tell us. However, only it is irrelevant. What is important is that the Lech Lech message came through when Abraham began to pack his bags and make himself ready for the journey. He found out to his great surprise that his father's bags had been packed long ago. This is important. Father and son, it's very dramatic. Father and son, who now locked in mortal combat, in mortal struggle, have joined hands and started out on the great march to Canaan. Now, I believe the objection which the Ramban raised against Ibn Ezra, that the order was given to Abraham prior to the departure from Mukazi, and Ramban points out that the Terah introduces Terah as the hero, as the central figure of this adventure, but not Abraham. I believe this objection, the objection to the view of Ibn Ezra, is not very disturbing, not very disturbing. The Torah is more interested in the metamorphosis that took place in Terach than in Abraham's compliance with the Word of God. That Abraham complied with the Word of God is known, and the Torah will have many opportunities to tell us about it. Many opportunities. The finest opportunity the Torah had is the episode of the Akedah to demonstrate his loyalty, his total commitment, and so forth. And the greatest story in the Torah here in Each is not Abraham's compliance. It is the tshuva of Terach. And the greatest story of the Baal tshuva is implicitly contained in the verse of Ayikach Terach. This spontaneous decision to abandon everything he stood for, loved, and defended, the change from an idolater into a member of Abraham's household, fellowship, his emigration from Kazdin, from Ur Kazdin, is the great miracle which the Torah is interested to tell us, and with which the Torah is concerned. Of course, the Torah tells us in a few words, in one verse, but the verse is not just a story about a journey, a story about a dramatic change in a great person. Abraham emerged victorious. Perhaps it's one of the great victories of Abraham. He convinced his own father. And the whole Abraham had very limited luck with his family. He couldn't convert his brother Nocher. The Horan was there. They couldn't convert Nochet. Psuel was not converted. The home was dead of an idolater. I mean, he had limited luck, limited success, even with his very devoted nephew, Lot. I don't remember where I came across this pshat. The problem of Lachor, what Lachor is. You know, what Rashi says, or Ramban. I saw somewhere, I don't remember. That Lachor means, in English, for thyself, it means you alone. Don't take along anybody of your household, of your family. Just you and Saul go forth thereafter. What could Avram do? Late? That's not logical. Why you left it late? And see, all right, since late accompanied him, trailed behind him, you Avram had to take care of late, to supervise him, to teach him, to train him. First the prophet says, Vayelech itelet. Vayelech Avram, kasher diber elav ad Hashem, Vayelech itelet. Later in behind. Avram didn't want it. Avram might have said to him, listen, you stay home, you're home, why do you have to start out an adventurous journey? What are you looking for? What are you searching? But apparently, late refused. Late had his sense of loyalty. Chazal already, emphasized that. Late had his sense of loyalty. Of devotion to him. No, once late trailed behind him, so by Yikr Abram, as Sora Yishter is playing the it means he guided him, he led him, he trained him, he taught him. But he had of course you know the Rashi, you all know the Rashi, by Yikr late is Kikra Yahweh, so the famous exclamation by late, and in a rate with Abram, the Lady Lekov. I have no use for Abraham, nor do I have any use for his God. I mean, he had very limited success. However, he had great success with his father. And basically it's important because the great teacher must be capable of influencing his own family. If one failed vis-à-vis his family in He handed down to them his convictions, his ideals. In an imperfect arm, his vision, his aspirations, his hopes, he cannot be a teacher, a great teacher, as far as strangers are concerned. Teaching begins at home. And how could Avraham become the great teacher of nations? Avraham and Gehem and Adira. If he had failed the miserable of his Macher, he failed miserable of his Psuel, failed miserable of his legs. The answer is yes. But he was successful with one member of his household, this Tach. As a matter of fact, Avraham emerged victorious. He convinced, he converted his own father, and I would say Abraham did not tell anything. He saw Terach ready to start out on the journey. He feigned obedience and officially followed his father. He kept himself in the background. First of all, there is Kibbutz Av. The Rambam passing that Kibbutz Av, one is due, Kibbutz Av is due even to a father who is a Roshe, but Terach was the great Baal Tshuva. So certainly Avraham was obligated, I mean, to give him respect. I mean, but not only because of Kibbutz Av. Another reason has prompted Avraham to keep himself in the background and not to interfere with Terach, and let Terach appear as the initiator, as the one who leads his family, the one who actually, I mean, has arrived at a revolutionary decision to leave Ur Kasdim, because Terach was indeed a hero. He was the Baal Tshuva. Abraham remains in the background. He knew well the Mokim Shebaal Tshuva in the Tzadikim Gemurim and Yechivim Lamed. The Terach departure is a heroic performance, and that only a great man could rise to such heights of heroic action. Interesting is the Midrash. There's a pasuk in Yev, Nehitein Mitomei Toer, Alei Yarod. A very strange pasuk, a very difficult pasuk. The more in Yidah says, Nehitein Dam Cholof Medav, Cholof Medav. The Midrash says, Nehitein Mitomei Toer, who can actually make a Tomei to yield Tar? You have the rule, I eat my Tomei, Tomei is my Toer Toer, Alei Yarod, Holy God, the Almighty. So that Melra says Avraham et Terach. Why Avraham et Terach? The answer is as follows. Avraham was a prophet. Avraham has his rendezvous with God. God, I mean, reached the covenant with Abraham. Of course, Avraham was hallowed as a prophet, as the father of the nation. But Avraham was a great man. In the natural terror. Avraham, after all, Avraham did start this prophecy. In this regard, Rambam already was aware of the distinction between Avraham and Meshe. Meshe started out as a prophet. Meshe did not search God at that hour. Meshe was completely absorbed and immersed in his daily activities. Meshe raised Saint Israel. But suddenly, God actually imposed himself upon Meshe. He converged upon himself. He forced him, I mean, to faith. To face eternity and to change his life and simply, I mean, and to reach a covenant with him. I mean, Meshe, you know, Meshe pleaded with God and did not accept the mission immediately. Avraham searched God before God revealed himself to Abraham. He searched, he was questing for him. Avraham had many questions. The most beautiful biography of Avraham, the image, the profile of Avraham, is projected by the Rambam. But who he says, if I remember exactly, he himself in Mushkabu Kazdin, he was immersed in Avodah Zarah idolatry, and himself worshipped the idols, but Libi Hoyom is shaken. He was restless. His mind was exploring. He was dissatisfied. He had many doubts, many questions. So Abraham, who was had imaginative, I mean, in great imagination, he had vision. His mind was that of a genius. I mean, he asked questions and rejected false answers. There was depth to his intuition. There was breadth to his understanding. I mean, there was greatness to the entire personality. Otherwise, he would have never become Abraham. Otherwise, God wouldn't have chosen him as the prophet, as the teacher, as the Avraham in Gein, as the father of all nations. All right, you know very well, talents, capabilities, capacities are not just, passed on from nowhere. They are hereditary. Who gave it to him? Who passed it on to him? Who handed it down to him? Terach, Rav Zeichel Ebnei, Rabbi Kivu Eimer. So the greatness already, but the trouble is Terach wasted his talent. He didn't utilize the talent, like many of us. We don't utilize our talents, for the proper constructive purposes. But Abraham, actually, in Abraham, the talents found the proper person and the opportunity, and fruition and realization. This in Yitim Mitzvah Mitoer Ale Echot Ve'Avrom Mitarach. There's another problem here. Elo Oretz Asher Arekot. We all know what Rashi says, Elo Oretz Asher Arekot. Le'om Alei, Yed Rashi, Elo Oretz Asher Arekot. Just a moment. Legil is Oretz. It is not revealed in the identity of the land. Kid Miyad, Kid Mechabur Beinov. Lemos Leschah, Kol Dibur Adibur. And Rashi quotes the Akedah as well. In the Akedah also, Lech Lecha Lerech Tamirio, Valeyu Shom Leilo, Allah Adorim Asherim Alech. He did not designate the mount, so say the mount will be pointed out to you when you are rising there from the Leilo. But even in Ashkita, you won't miss enough. But there is quite a difference between the command of Lech Lecha and the command of Lech Lecha Lerech Tamirio. In Eretz Samaria, he told Abraham where to go. He told him the destination of Eretz Samaria. Abraham knew more or less where the Eretz Samaria is. What? He just didn't reveal to him the identity of the mount. Alright? So this is a simple matter. Here, when he said to him, Lech lecho, me'arz lecho, me'laditecho, u'me'beis savicho, elo Eretz asher areko. He didn't tell him southward, proceed southward. Nor did he tell him proceed northward, or eastward, or westward. There are so many directions. So actually, where did Abraham go? So the Ramban says, "Who you needed v'elech, migoy al goy, he wandered from people to people, mamloch al amacher, ad shibu al oretz Kna'an, v'amelu l'zarach oetz musoretz, v'oz niskayim al oretz asher areko, v'oz nisaki v'yoshavu." ומה שאומר ויקח אברום אסור הישתי וייצו הולך את ארץ הכנען ויובילו ארץ הכנען לא נעשייה שבו כדאי ליובע כי אורץ ההיא נצטווה אלא שאורך הסדיק דרכי דרך ארץ כנען כי כאילו היה בדייטי ובדעס עודיך גם התחילו בצייסו מורכבים ומפני זה אומר ויקח אשר איסו איסי אליקים ובישרבי כי הוא יותה כסה אלי. What does the Ramban want to convey here? Let me say, the Ramban touches here upon a very important subject, namely, how did Abraham guess where he was supposed to go, to move? The Ramban, like Rashi, held the view that the Almighty did not specify the place where he wants Abraham to settle or to arrive, but ordered him in general terms to go forth from his native land. Or the question arises, how could Abraham know where to go? Where to go? Eastward, westward, southward, and northward, When Abraham was instructed sometime later to sacrifice Yitzchak, the Almighty told him specifically, and gave him the land of the Moriah, Abraham knew that where he was supposed to travel. Even though the mount upon which the sacrifice was supposed to take place was not singled out, and the order addressed to Abraham in what caused him did not entail any specifics. That's what the Ramban refers by saying Vayi kasher isu esi elikim ebeisori. It's a very strange phrase, Vayi kasher isu. You should have said Vayi kasher lokochani elikim ebeisori. It's simple. Or Vayi kasher imichuni elikim ebeisori. Simple. I check translations, I mean, they say it took me out of my father's home. But this is not correct. This does not actually, I mean, convey the semantics of Isu. What does Isu mean? I would say Kashrizu came, and it came to pass when God caused me to be lost. To be lost, confused. And Ramah asked something. He wandered like a stray sheep, not knowing, I mean, where to start and how to get back, how to return home. The Ramban emphasizes indeed Abraham was confused and perplexed like a stray sheep. In other words, not a strange. God could have told him, go southward, it was southward. From Syria, from Haran to Israel. He didn't say a single word. Lech Lecha, El Orat Asherecha. Where the land is? God didn't specify. There was no compass, I mean, to lead, to guide Abraham. God did not guide Abraham. He wanted to bewilder him. Kasher Yisru is the name. He completely mystified and confounded him. He told him to move on, to go forth, where? El Orat Asherecha. How is the land to be found? Where is the land to be found? In the east or in the west? No hint was disclosed to Abraham. God willed Abraham. What did God will Abraham? He confused him, bewildered him. Abraham was perplexed, like a stray sheep, he said it. He wanted Abraham to find, to discover the proper land by himself. He wanted Abraham to guess, to find out intuitively, to somehow smell the land from afar. It's a very strange request of Abraham. He wanted somehow he should even magically feel the pull that the land exerts upon people, to be attracted by the land spontaneously. And he wanted Abraham intuitively to be fascinated by the land, then this intuition, this subconscious intuition, should guide Abraham into Eretz Canaan. The way, I mean, birds are guided flying south in fall or returning home in the spring. They don't know where they are going. It's a mechanical push. We don't know scientifically actually what guides them. There are many theories. But man is certain. But there is some mechanical push. There is some inner instinct which actually guides them to their destination. And apparently the Rebbeinu Shlomo wanted Abraham to be guided not by his mind, but by his heart. Not by logic, but by intuition. Abraham should not only comply with the word of God, he should develop in himself the capacity for distinguishing between Kadesh Rachel, between holiness, I mean, and profanity, between Eretz Canaan and other lands. He didn't give him any criteria. No hints were disclosed to Abraham. Abraham by himself, by his personal genius, by his personal intuition, must be guided and led to Eretz Canaan. It's a very strange task. It's a very difficult mandate. And Abraham being mistaken in his adventurous selection of land, it was an adventure. Everything would have been lost. Abraham would not have been the chosen leader and patriarch. It's a pasuk. Atu Adishem Melekim Asha Bochalto Be Avram Veitzeisinu Kazvin Vesamto Shnei Avram. It's very strange. Thou art the God who has chosen Abraham and took him out of Ur Kazvin and changed his name into Abraham. Basically the order is not chronologically, it does not follow, I mean, the proper chronology. Because actually God has chosen Abraham after arriving in Eretz Canaan. And then his name was changed from Avram into Abraham. This was the sign of the token and the symbol of charismatic, I mean, choice and selection, elevation, salvation. But this is what the apostle wants to convey is that the exodus from Chaldea and the task with which Avram was charged to find the land presented Abraham with the crucial test of whether or not he is worthy of the divine charisma and divine individual attention and elevation to the great height of Avraham Avinu Mesatecho. The test did consist in Abraham's, not in Abraham's conforming to the divine decree, this was an easy matter, but in his uncanny intuition concerning the destination of his travels and wanderings. And apparently Abraham has guessed right. He felt without being able to explain his feelings that the destination is Canaan, and that's why Abraham had it toward Canaan long before God revealed himself and told him, you found the right land. Vayikach Avraham et Sarah ishto, v'sleit ben ochiv, v'yetzu v'meches al tuknan, v'yoveil al tuknan. Of course, the emphasis is upon v'yetzu v'meches al tuknan. However, there is something else. If you look into the Ramban and you read it carefully, the Ramban says something else. כי הארץ ההיא נסתמו, כי עדיין לא יודע כי הארץ ההיא נסתמו. אלא שאוך הצדיק דרכי דרך ארץ כנען, which is guessing, sheer guessing המספר, כי כן אם הוא יודע בדייטי, that's the way he felt, when he came up with the idea, this is the way he intuitively felt, that's all. Intuitively felt, it was not no logic involved in it, there was no discursive thinking involved, because he had no premises with which to work. I mean, if you want to think out the problem and discuss the terms, you need premises. I mean, the behavior had no premises. Everything was done ex nihilo, so to say. Disastrous. Because Terach also had a lo leches al tuknan. Why did Ramban introduce the Hasarif? Ramban points out something very interesting. Not only was Abraham blessed with the uncanny intuition, but Terach as well. The latter was determined, also determined, to travel to Canaan. Vayikach Terach et Avraham ויצא פנדוק מבשורו יקר לא עושה ויצא את המרכז עם הלכת על הסכנן. His father fell also fell the mysterious pool that this land exerted at Pandora's research meaning and a rationale in creation in our questing for God. כי אם הוא ידודאי תהיו את הסוביב גם התחילו בסיס המרכז. Why was Canaan chosen first by Terach and later by Abraham? Or as we said, intuitively, subconsciously, almost mechanically. It is somehow a response which is not explainable in the rational terms. A response to what? After all, if you speak about intuition, something must arouse intuition. There should be some stimulus. I mean, you respond to stimulus. You don't respond, I mean, to nothing. What was the stimulus? What attracted? What fascinated? What pulled him? What dragged him? Did drag itself? Terach as well as everyone. What? There should be stimulus. There is no response without the stimulus, you know that? And here is the central idea in Yahadus. Comes to expression. You'll ask me what was pulling Abraham to Eretz Canaan outward? What was pulling Terach outward to Eretz Canaan? The idea of Kedusha. This was perhaps the greatest discovery made by Abraham. The Deir HaMabul, people respond always. people not only Abraham, all generations, since Bria's Ayon, since the creation of the world until the day, respond to some stimulus. And they usually respond not logically. Usually they respond not in terms of discursive thought, not in terms of utilitarian and pragmatic considerations. They respond blindly, mechanically, spontaneously, without thinking. The major decisions in one's life, the major decisions, secondary decisions are reached on the basis of calculations, of calculating thinking. I mean, simply you weigh the pros and the cons, profits and loss, and you finally arrive at a conclusion slowly and cautiously and carefully. But major decisions in life come suddenly, intuitively. There's no calculating mind. There is a passionate car which reaches the decision and tells men to act. This is basic. This is true. I mean, if you analyze your whole life, I mean, you'll find it out. So people respond to stimulus. People respond to a challenge. It's a powerful challenge. Basically, the Vera Marvel also responded. The Otomarishna had responded. Have an Otomarishna. They responded to the challenge of the Itada. But the Vera Marvel responded to a challenge. To what challenge did the Vera Marvel respond? To the challenge of beauty. The Vera Marvel thought that beauty is fascinating and that one must succumb to beauty, yield to the power of beauty. There are modern thoughts that one must respond quickly to the aesthetic challenge, to succumb to the beautiful and the present. It means if you respond quickly to that challenge, it means that challenge is the central goal and the central objective of man. Vayu bnei alekim ez bnei sorodom ki teirem seno vayitchu lehem noshi mekila asha b'chor. They responded to the fair woman, which is the symbol of beauty. As a matter of fact, modern man still is a captive of beauty, of the aesthetic experience. What you've got to understand under aesthetic experience means not only just beauty in the sense of what we understand the colloquial English sense of symmetry and so forth, harmony and so forth, but it means that, I mean, it means an entire world view, I mean, which revolves about men enjoying life, taking advantage of life, exploiting opportunities, I mean, always availing himself of various possibilities. This is still, modern man is still a captive of beauty. The Vera Flogge also responded. As a matter of fact, the ideal of beauty was introduced by the Nechash. Nechmod Uleinahem. It was the response of Eve to the Eitzadah. Of course, it was built on to future generations. Finally, beauty, I mean, resulted in a deluge. The aesthetic society disintegrated by itself and imperished. This is basically now. What's wrong with the army? Speak about the revolt of the campuses. I mean, rebellion. What do they want? What do they challenge? Even the hippies with their long beards and their neglected appearance. It is aesthetic experience. To enjoy everything. No restraints. No checks, no controls. This is aesthetic experience. The aesthetic experience basically is an infinite experience. It is boundless. You want to grab as much as possible. You reach out for the impossible. There are no laws which prevent man, which control man, which discipline man. Basically, the aesthetic experience, in contradistinction to the ethical experience, resents discipline.
who by the ethical experience recommend discipline, because ethical experience expresses itself through disciplined life. He's realized through discipline and self-control and self-restraint. The aesthetic experience resents disciplines. All barriers are torn down. All senses are abandoned. All restraints are rejected. I do what I like. What do I like? Whatever is pleasant, whatever is comfortable. I resent our authority. I resent tradition. I resent everything. I resent the past. I'm not interested in the future. There's only one moment, the fleeting present. The door of logic thoughts, the door of logic thoughts, but a different philosophy. The great challenge of man is power. When man should not enjoy life, man should be powerful. Omnipotent. The great challenge is if man sets up himself as God, as an idol. Technological achievement, basically as they have law, technological achievement. Of course, in terms of antiquity, the there of logic thought puzzles man, holds him prisoner, makes him worthy of being man. The Jews who made technological achievement and man's control, partial control, or limited control, over his environment possible, should be worshipped. And of course, the communist society is not a Vera model, much to know. We're making a mistake. That's the weakness on the part of the Western society on which the communist society does not suffer. The Western society is just like a Vera model. No restraints, no more law. You enjoy life, you feel comfortable, and you take out of life as much as possible. And the rest you resent. You don't care for tomorrow, you're not interested in the yesteryear. You are simply, you live for the present, of course. That means a breakdown of discipline, a breakdown of order, a breakdown of collapse of all checks and controls and restraints, I mean, which keep human society together, a disintegration society. In their flog is different. The Tere described their flog as a highly organized unit there. I mean, the Chazal also tried, they used to carry bricks, I mean, for years and years. And if a baby, I mean, fell from the tower, I mean, they ignored. But if a brick fell, I mean, they used to mourn and grieve over it. It means the invention is more important than the human being. Technological achievement is superior, I mean, to the dignity of the individual. It's a well-organized, closely knit society. With an army, with a youth which is conscious of its task, which marches simply straight toward a certain goal. The goal is conquest. Again, infinity. This is the challenge to which the Terra Flogger responded. And this is the greatest challenge. It was the greatest challenge in the eyes of the Terra Flogger. Communist society is the Terra Flogger. The great challenge is technological power. And of course the idealization of man as the genius who made everything possible, who made possible for the Apollo 7 to cruise and to orbit around the Earth for 11 days. And of course again there is infinity. You reach out for the moon and from the moon for the planet and so forth. It's again man who wants to be successful. Man wants to be triumphant. Man considers himself a hero. Man hates to be defeated. He wants to be successful either as an aesthete or as a powerful engineer. Abraham proclaimed a new challenge, a new idea to the world. That of Kedusha. The great challenge of man is Kedusha. Kedusha fascinates. Abraham said that man knows aspirations, hopes, visions, dreams, and yearnings. He is out not to gain power. is out not to gain the maximum enjoyment and carnal pleasure. He is out only to find God and to cling to it. In order to cling to God and to find God and to be close to Him, man does not have to be successful, always successful. Man can afford the luxury of being defeated. So, yeah. Kedusha has a strange quality. Very strange quality. I would say Kedusha is a dialectical experience. It's an antithetic experience. It frightens people, but at the same time it also pulls and attracts people. There is fascinating in daunting as far as Kedusha is concerned. It is daunting, you know, what kind of people? Who refuse to think. It frightens, you know, what kind of people? Who refuse to feel, to delve in themselves, in the mystery of man, any strange destiny. People with platitudes, people with cliches, people who don't know themselves are frightened by Kedusha, because Kedusha demands sacrifice and self-defeat sometimes. However, for people blessed with sweep of imagination, depth of perception, breadth of thought, and boldness as character, Kedusha is the fascinating experience which pulls them to the bare realm unconsciously, instinctually, I would even say mechanically. And I believe I said it once, when David the psalmist describes his yearning for God, his questing for God, he avails himself a strange metaphor. Like the gazelle questing or yearning for the brook when she is carried, so I yearn for you. Question is obvious. Why this metaphor? Why did he have to compare himself to this the gazelle or with the deer, with an animal of the field? He could have said, Nafshi Tarek, that's funny. Good enough. Why should the metaphor of the gazelle, of the ayolo, here enhance, I mean, so to say, the meaning of what he wanted to convey, that he wanted to convey? He says, no, why should it become more exalted? Why should his yearning become more exalted, more enhanced, if compared to that of a gazelle? The answer is, if you saw once, I mean, how in Africa, in the jungle, late in the afternoon, the animals begin to march, walk. All kinds of animals, buffaloes and deer, gazelles, all kinds of animals. I mean, they walk, where are they walking? To where? Do they know that over there, I mean, 5 miles away, there is a brook? The animal doesn't know that. There's no memory. There's no accumulated experience in the animal. So how do they know the way? No one can explain the way the birds find their way. I mean, when they fly the southward, I mean, in fall, I mean, they march. They are pushed, they are driven by something irrational, by something which is unexplainable. But this drive does not cease. Does not terminate until the animal reaches the brook. When it reaches the brook, it stoops and drinks the water. So is man. Man is driven to the bare realm. Sometimes subconsciously, unconsciously, mechanically driven. He cannot get away from the bare realm. If man tries to get away from the bare realm, it means he destroys himself. Destroys himself and destroys society. As a matter of fact, I mean, we have almost reached this stage of the game. I mean, modern society. And of course, you know very well, if one tries to repress his basic drives, what kind of a personality he develops as a result of repression. I don't have to tell it to you. Yeah. And that's what David said. unknowingly, unconsciously, mechanically, instinctually. It's not a result of my philosophy. It's not a result of my meditation. It's not a result of reflection. It's not a result of self-searching or self-examination. Of course, all these things will enhance the drive, will convert a mechanical drive into a conscious quest. But the drive exists regardless of everything and in spite of everything. It exists everywhere, whether a person considers himself an atheist or an agnostic or a scientist. This drive is to be found, I mean, in every person. It drives him like the thirst drives the gazelle to the brook of water. And that's exactly what Knaan meant to Abraham, what Knaan meant to God. It drove them mechanically, instinctually. And they were as restless and unhappy, separate, until they found the Rabbeinu Shlom in Eretz.
Friends, we will daven Maariv now. The reception will take place in 20 minutes in the red room adjoining this room. Please, Chavarim, friends, have your tickets available for presentation. Dinner will be